This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 285 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. I'm not supposed to talk about the weather, but if it wasn't for the weather, I probably wouldn't be here since we're recording this earlier. So we got a bit of a snow day. So I'd like to thank the weather so I could be here on time.
Very good. Also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, and he's probably also got something to say about the weather that we're not supposed to talk about.
No, I'm not going to talk about the weather at all, actually, because it was sunny. Well, I guess that would be weather. I mean, it's the first time at least that I've seen the sun in Chicago in, I don't know, 11 years, I think, or something. I don't
know. Well, very good. I'm glad to hear that. No more snow for Chicago, I guess.
Oh, no, tomorrow. Actually, we're supposed to get 8 inches tomorrow.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Mike Collins. Now, Mike is a longtime professional photojournalist. In fact, he created the Southern Aviator back in the late 1980s. Now he's the technical editor for AOPA Pilot and Flight Training. He's also the director of business operations for AOPA's publishing activities. And he's also director of the International Society for Aviation Photography. And if that's not enough, Mike is also an instrument-rated private pilot. So, Mike, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thanks, Max. It's a privilege to be here tonight. And regarding the weather that we're clearly not supposed to be talking about, my mom always told me that if you can't say something nice about someone, or I guess something, not to say anything at all. So I have absolutely nothing to say about the weather tonight.
Okay, very good.
And where are you from, Mike, originally? I mean, mom would say that to you.
Well, originally from Cleveland, Ohio, but spent most of my childhood and formative years in Lexington, Kentucky, and then bounced around a little bit in the newspaper business and have been here in Frederick, Maryland, working with the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association for this summer. I'll be 20 years.
Wow.
Okay.
Now, Mike, when I was in, well, let's say high school, there were professions that I aspired to. One was to be a professional race car driver, and that didn't work out. And the other one was actually to be a photojournalist. It's something that I was always very interested in. Is that something that you were also interested in at a young age, or did you sort of fall into that?
Well, no, I mean, I guess I did kind of fall into it, but I guess it was in sixth grade or seventh grade, a good friend of mine got a darkroom set up for Christmas. I had already had a bit of an interest in photography, and we basically taught ourselves how to do black and white film processing and printing. This was obviously before the internet, so you could either go out and buy a book, which I don't think we did, or you could just read the directions on the different things that you would buy at the camera shop, and I think that's more what we did. And you know, we had some flaws with our initial efforts. We got confused as to what was optional and what wasn't. So mm-hmm. when you washed film, there's a solution called a washing aid that is optional. It helps speed the time. Well, we thought that the whole washing process was optional. So we would fix our film, hang it to dry. Well, it worked great, but then you know, a couple weeks later, it would just the film would deteriorate prematurely. We eventually figured that out, but it got me interested into photography at a different level. And so I progressed up through high school, even junior high and high school newspaper, yearbook, those kind of things, decided to cast my lot into photojournalism. Hmm. It's like so many things in the advent of the internet era, it's evolved a little bit. Back then, photojournalism, a lot of us, I think, saw it as telling stories with pictures. But I quickly learned, and it's kind of an extension of, you know, the a good picture is worth a 1,000 words or 10,000 words, depending on whose math you use. But a good picture or pictures with a short story is even more valuable to your reading audience. So yes. I learned how to write as well, which was a little bit of a novelty when I started wearing the multiple hats. And but I'm glad I did, because it's, you know, opened the door to a lot of opportunities for me. Now in the internet age, those of us who are journalists for AOPA and a lot of other outlets now also have to do video. So I'm a little bit unique in that I'm certainly one of a minority that can go out on a story and do the story, the photos, and the video. But that ability has allowed me to do things like this this MU-2 flight around the world, where there would not have been an opportunity to send a writer and a photographer and a videographer. So it's definitely been interesting. It's certainly not what I thought I'd end up doing, but I also can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot about your flight around the world. And it sounds like you were the perfect guy for that role. So we'll look forward to talking about that. And maybe we can get into a little bit about photojournalism in aviation. And I think some of our listeners may be interested in some tips or some suggestions for how they might pursue a career like that. But before we do that, we're going to talk about the week's aviation news. We have a bunch of stories that we're going to mention and discuss a little bit. And let's see, David, do we have a history segment?
We do. We're going to do something close to home for me. We're going to talk about the Augusta Westland 139 helicopter for once.
Ooh, all right. Interesting. And we have an Australia desk coming up after that. We'll see if Steve has made it back in front of the mic. Peter Johnson is off this week, so no Across the Pond segment. And then, as always, we'll close out with a little bit of the great listener mail that we received in the past week. First, though, let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Our first article comes from Global Times. This is titled, Over 100 Cities in China Building or Planning General Aviation Parks. The Chinese National Development and Reform Commission has approved 10 aerospace, high-tech industrial bases at the national level. But in addition to that, the article points out that there are 116 cities in China that are building or planning to build GA industrial parks. Now, we've talked about the potential growth or the growth that that China is expecting to see in general aviation, and this is sort of another example of that. Now, they do need companies to join the industrial parks, but what they really need is pilots. What do you think, Mike, about the growth of the prospects for the growth of general aviation in China?
China's an interesting one. I think a lot of people feel there is an awful lot of potential there. There's a lot of activity by the Chinese in general aviation-oriented aerospace beyond the Cessna Skycatcher, which was being manufactured in China and then shipped back to the United States. One of the issues that I think they're facing is, and it's not an uncommon issue in other parts of the world, but if I recall correctly, the military owns, quote-unquote, the airspace over all of China. Right. And getting airspace for civilian operations has been a challenge for them. There is a fledgling AOPA affiliate in China they have actually sent delegations over to the United States a number of times. They've come to D.C. and met with the FAA and other government agencies. They've come up to AOPA headquarters in Frederick, Maryland, where they've learned about general aviation and about GA airports and gotten introductory flights in general aviation aircraft. So the wheels are starting to turn. I can't say how quickly they're turning, but there is interest, and people there are going through the channels, whatever those channels are, to try to get airspace made available for civilian use.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard about the Chinese delegation coming to AOPA in the U.S., but I think that's great. I assume they were welcomed with open arms, fellow aviators and all that. I know certainly we compete with China economically and in other areas as well. But is it safe to say that, you know, we're all brothers when it comes to aviation?
Oh, I think so. I think so. You know, the interesting thing to me is when this delegation, I've been in Frederick at least a couple times when they've visited. And one time I was out on the ramp and photographing their first flight experiences. And for many of them, it was their first actual opportunity to fly in a general aviation aircraft. The only flying they'd done had been in, you know, much larger air carrier aircraft, you know, in row 44 instead of row 1. And just to see their faces as they taxied out, and then when they came back, you know, they had that universal pilot smile plastered across their faces.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, and I think something else that's really interesting is that we've had a bunch of Chinese business folks over to our flying club over in Chicago here because of our affiliation with Northwestern. And what I found, beside the fact that the people were just so excited to look at these small airplanes, what I also found is that they were just bowled over when I was able to tell them that if you wanted to, you could just take off today, right now, after you pre-flighted, and go that way for an hour and land and have lunch, and then go that away for another hour and then come back home, and you would just be able to do this all on your own. And they are just astounded at that, because as Mike said, the airspace in China is so tightly controlled by the military that no one, it's not like they knew they could do it and they were being held back. It just never even crossed their mind. And that's what I thought was so amazing.
Well, if we move on to our next story, you talk about being controlled. Southwest Airlines has been controlled to a certain degree by this thing called the Wright Amendment. And we see in a Southwest press release, big news for a big D, Southwest Airlines announces new nonstop destinations. So this Wright Amendment, this is imposed some flight restrictions. I think this goes back, what, Rob, back to 1979 or something, doesn't it?
Long time. It was the, Mike might know this, David Wright, isn't that Jim Wright, who was the Speaker of the House, I think, at the time or something? But they put this in to protect DFW when it was first coming together, in terms of making sure that the two airports were not competing. But it did have a sunset, and that sunset is coming up at the end of the year. And since I get to go to Dallas a lot for business, I can finally go up and back direct to Dallas without stopping in some crazy place, which is what they would make you do with the Wright Amendment. You could not go anywhere direct, or with certain cities you could not go direct beyond a certain distance. And now they're going to have all the restrictions removed.
Yeah, I think Rob, the flights had to could not go any farther than several certain adjoining states, and so you could go nonstop to, say, Little Rock, but you couldn't go nonstop to Chicago or Baltimore or something like that. I forget exactly the year, but it was definitely put in place to protect DFW from the threat of Love Field.
And who knows? With all that love, and they I guess there just wasn't enough love to go around, huh?
Well, this has certainly got to make Southwest happy. The article points out that they're going to add destinations service Some on October 13th and some more on November 2nd, of course, 2014. And on the October 13th, they're adding BWI, Baltimore, Washington, Denver, Las Vegas, Orlando, Chicago, Midway. And then in November on the 2nd, they are adding Atlanta, Nashville, Reagan National, Fort Lauderdale, LAX, New York, LaGuardia, Phoenix, San Diego, Orange County, Santa Ana, and Tampa.
But who's counting?
But who's counting? I think this about doubles the service, a nonstop service from Dallas to additional destinations. So yeah, Southwest has got to be happy about that.
And don't forget, they also announced that they're now international.
That's right. We've seen that lately too.
Picking up all the AirTran routes down to the Caribbean.
That's right. We I remember speculating about that stuff years ago with Dan Webb about whether they were going to expand internationally or not. And yeah, we're seeing some activity there. All right, next item comes from Digital Journal. New Hampshire city ignores FAA, uses drone for video. So Nashua, New Hampshire, actually a very nice little town to visit. They contracted with a video production company to produce a couple of videos, two videos promoting the community. And the UAV was used to capture aerial video that you can only get really with a UAV, with a drone. David, there's a problem with this, though, isn't there?
Yeah, it's against the law. You're using a UAV for commercial services. Unless, of course, we talk about what we've talked about on UAV Digest, where you don't charge them for the use of the UAV, but you charge them for film processing, and suddenly you can do this. It's that gray area that we wish the FAA would get off their little butts and solve for all of us.
Yeah, you're right, David. This is a kind of another piece of a continuing theme over at the UAVDigest.com that we do, where people are finding really great applications for quadcopters or hexacopters or things like that, only to find out sometimes afterwards that unless you have the special authorization from the FAA, which they don't grant very often, you're not allowed to do these kinds of commercial activities. And a lot of people have gotten in trouble. One guy's been fined. Others have been shut down. So here we see yet another example of that, sort of a recurring theme.
I thought that was kind of fun. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, some of you all may have seen on some of the social media channels, I guess it was going around just before the Super Bowl, but there was a brewery up in Wisconsin, Lake Maid Brewery, I believe, that was using some sort of copter drone to ferry half cases of bottled beer to ice fishermen out in their little shanties on the lake. And they got a no, you can't do that anymore letter from the FAA, apparently. I was actually fairly impressed because the payload was a lot larger than what I've seen for most of these fly-it-yourself type copters. I thought, you know, well, if they had done canned beer, it would have been a lot less tear weight and they could have delivered more actual beer per flight. But I don't know if it was something they were actually doing or just a promo video, but regardless, it got the FAA's attention from what I've heard.
Well, and a shout out to our friend Sam out in Wisconsin. The reason why he thought the beer was being carried looked so well was because it was light beer. So that was the funniest joke, and Max and I talked about this last week. Yeah, that was, out of the whole video, the most impressive part of that was the capacity of the hexacopter to carry the half case of beer out to what Max has described as ice fishermen, which he was very negative about. But you need to listen to episode 23 of UAV Digest.
All right, let's move on. The next item, this comes from an Aviation Week article, Does Commercial Aviation Need a Mega Twin? Now, you might have seen in the press that Airbus is under some pressure from some of its customers to upgrade the A330 with the kind of engines that are more fuel efficient and available on newer airplanes, sort of an A330 Neo, if you will. But according to this article, Airbus is studying something called an NLR twin jet, a new long range twin jet, something that seats 470 passengers. And this may be in response to Boeing's recently launched 777X. But, you know, it's kind of hard to tell. I'm not sure if Airbus really has the appetite for an all-new airplane right now. And I don't know if maybe big twin jets will perhaps kill off the four-engine jets. I don't know. Any thoughts on this, guys?
I think four-engine jets are soon to be gone, other than maybe the A380 and some old 7-4s. I mean, the price of fuel is so exorbitant that it almost demands that they go to two engines. But I know people that fly 7-4s, and they call a 777 a light twin because they don't like flying around in two-motor airplanes out, you know, 5,000 miles from the shore or something like that.
Yeah, two large jet engines on a twin will burn less than four smaller engines on a four-engine plane, typically. But the new engines, you know, we see the stuff that's on the 787, and they just offer significantly better fuel burn. And, you know, the other thing is that Airbus may be just sort of positioning and posturing, because part of this game with Boeing and Airbus is it's a chess game in a lot of respects. And you're always trying to figure out what your competition is going to be doing and what the timing of the things that they do are, so that you can, you know, you can plan accordingly. So I think that's a big issue that may be at play here. The other thing is we're seeing so many new aircraft and derivatives of aircraft, and all those take up a lot of engineering talent. And so the question you always have to ask, or at least in that environment, is does the company have the engineering resources to do something significant, that next big project? So it's interesting to talk about.
They're not ever going to make any money on the A380, from what the people I've talked to have said. And so putting all these other new aircraft together, I mean the 350 and perhaps re-engineering the 330, although that's a pretty popular airplane. They've got to be stretched. I mean, just like Boeing is, money-wise.
Dumb question. This has been done in military parlance, but has there ever been a re-engineering program for an airframe where they've taken like the A330 and given it new engines?
Yeah, they did that on the DC-8 a long, long time ago, I think, when they put those CFM engines on it and took the old, what were those, Pratt & Whitney's, I think?
Yeah, the old JT8Ds, I think.
Yeah.
Right, but that was based on a military conversion.
UPS did them. UPS converted, re-engined DC-8s and ran them for a long time. I think they're all out of service now, but I don't know what any of the specifics were on the fuel consumption. But I talked to a pilot who flew those for UPS, and the engines had so much more power than the original engines, that if you lost one, I was told that none of your speeds changed. Everything's exactly the same. If you lose two, you might have to change a couple knots. But I was impressed that you could lose an engine and not have to change any of your reference speeds. Now, maybe that's one of the things about four-engine airplanes, which I have pretty much zero experience in. So,
but now you were talking about air engines or engine upgrades that specifically began on the civilian side, I think, weren't you, David?
Everybody likes the 330. They don't like the engines currently on it. So why doesn't, it's kind of like the Neo, but you never see them go back and re-engine an existing airframe.
Yeah, I know there can be several reasons for it, and certainly we haven't seen it, I don't think, on a scale like we're seeing it now with the A320neo family and the 737 MAX, just hundreds and hundreds and thousands of aircraft with or orders for aircraft with newer engines, re-engines. It costs a lot of money. It's a significant investment to change the engine. It's not a matter of just swapping the engine out. There's a lot of engineering that has to go into it as well. So sometimes the business case may not warrant spending the billion or $2 billion it's going to take to re-engine, and it may be money better spent with a clean sheet of paper new airplane. It sort of depends on the circumstances. When you look at the A330, some of Airbus's customers are, you know, asking, well, why can't you take the engines from the 787 and use those? There's a complicating factor there in that the 787 engines don't use bleed air. The 787 is more of an electric airplane. So if you say, well, let's use those engines or a derivative of those engines on the A330, you've got to come up with bleed air somehow, because that's how that airplane operates. So there's a lot of engineering work there, a lot of cost and so forth. I think the decisions are made on a case-by-case basis. And in the case of the A320 and 737, the numbers justified the investment to change the engines. In other cases, you know, it won't. I think it's a case-by-case thing. All right. Again, we're speaking with Mike Collins. Mike's done a lot of interesting things, I think, in his career. But one of the things from last year, 2013, that was extremely interesting, Mike, is that you joined up with another Mike, right? Mike Laver. And
correct.
Flew a Mitsubishi MU-2 around the world. How did that come to be? What was the origin of your participation in this around the world flight?
Well, it's one of those things that starts with a most unlikely phone call, and Mike Laver, whose airplane we took on this trip, he's been a devotee of the MU-2 for going on 20 years. He flew them in Australia as a pilot and owner of a charter company, and then he came to the United States, and he has been buying and selling them. He owns a repair station that does overhauls on them. He's definitely a Mr. MU-2. He just loves the airplane, and it's a remarkably capable airplane. And he decided he wanted to do a flight around the world. He's done a lot of international flying, ferrying airplanes to and from different countries. But he wanted just a bucket list thing. He wanted to go around the world. And when he realized that September was the 50th anniversary of the model's first flight, he realized he wanted to time it so that he could be in Nagoya, where Mitsubishi assembled and initially flew all the MU-2s for the anniversary of that first flight. So he actually didn't start out looking for media coverage, but he had asked an old friend of mine who is a retired Air Force and now retired commercial pilot who owns an MU-2 as his personal aircraft, and invited him to accompany Mike on this trip. But my friend Ross's daughter was, fortunately for me, was getting married right in the middle of this trip, so he couldn't go. And so Mike asked him, well, who, do you know anybody that I should ask about this? And he said, well, let me call my friend Mike at AOPA and see if he might be interested. And that's the believe it or not, the short story. But we got to talking, and then we met and discussed plans and everything, and ended up doing this incredible 25-day trip around the world.
Now, let's describe the MU-2 a little bit for our listeners so they can kind of get a picture. Those who aren't familiar with it, this is a high-wing twin turboprop, and it's not a tiny aircraft, is it?
There's two fuselage sizes. There's the short body, which is the aircraft we flew, pilot and co-pilot, and then five seats in the back. And then there's a longer body that gives you two or three more passengers. So it's not a giant airplane. People have asked me what's the interior size like, and it's really about like a minivan. Two seats in the front and five seats in the back, and some room for stuff. For a GA pilot like me, it's a big airplane. But for people who are used to 74s and A380s, it's a little teeny tiny thing.
Let's get to the really interesting question, Mike, that everybody that's listening wants to know. You went around the world in this airplane. Does it have a potty in it?
No.
No. Did you know that in advance? I'm sure you did.
We knew that in advance, and we had contingency plans. We had some of the various devices that you can get from Sporty's and other catalogs that were available should they be needed. And I will say that I was successful at moderating my fluid intake. Okay. And did not need to use any of the emergency equipment. So that one of the hardest parts about this trip with so many early calls was getting through the day with just one cup of coffee. So
were there other or any modifications required to the plane or the systems or anything in order to fly it on this kind of a extended trip?
No, and part of that though was Mike Laver wanted to do the trip with the stock airplane. If we had wanted to come across the Pacific, for example, from Australia to Guam to somewhere to Hawaii to California, we would have had to put in ferry tanks and all the plumbing that comes with it. And as it turns out, neither of us was terribly excited about the idea of flying around the world or anywhere else in an airplane, full of fuel bladders and plastic tubes. So we did everything on ship's fuel, and it limited our legs a little bit, but it turns out that we had no problem at all making this trip work just with the ship's internal fuel.
And what was the duration of the trip, and how many miles did you cover?
We went. We covered 26,568 nautical miles, 98.1 hours of flight time at an average ground speed of 271 knots.
And did you have any? Were there any issues with the aircraft at all?
The aircraft performed flawlessly. Maybe Mike invoked the inverse corollary of Murphy's Law, because the airplane has two baggage compartments. We used one for our baggage, and we traveled fairly light. I took enough stuff for 2 weeks, and on my one day off in Australia, I spent half of that day at the hotel doing laundry, because by that point, I needed to do laundry. The other baggage compartment, Mike had filled with pretty much anything that he knew from his extensive experience operating the model that could possibly or had a high likelihood of possibly failing. We had an extra tire and a wheel, a starter generator, all sorts of things he had squirreled away in that baggage compartment. And except for the customs inspector in Russia who wanted to look in there, we never opened that hatch the whole trip. We didn't need anything. The closest thing we had to a mechanical really couldn't be blamed on the aircraft. And our very last stop, one leg away from getting back to Frederick, Maryland, the NFBO moved the airplane overnight. We grilled the FBO. They had an MU-2 on the field, and they professed a knowledge of how to properly move the aircraft. Unfortunately, the line person who moved the aircraft didn't have that knowledge, and a shear pin was sheared, and they figured it out immediately and called their maintenance guy in overnight to repair it. So they fessed up in the morning when we showed up, and we inspected it. Everything looked in order, and we had logbook entry documenting the repair. So it was a close call, but I did not consider that to be any fault of the airplanes. It was just unfortunate ground handling.
Rob, you want to jump in with some?
I was going to say, you can tell Mike is from the Washington D.C. area, because when he mentioned the guy on the ground was a complete idiot when it came to MU-2s, he didn't put it that way. He said the young fellow, didn't have that knowledge. See, and I think that's really nice that you were nice about that.
Yeah, it tells you a lot about Mike, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, and I can assure you that he has that knowledge now. So
yeah, right. He's learned that.
So, well, and I had very limited experience with the MU-2 before the trip, but and I don't know how familiar you all or your audience is, but the airplane is pretty interesting to fuel. The aircraft has actually six fuel tanks. The main tanks are inboard. There's a smaller kind of a locker tank further out on the wing. And then the airplane has 90-gallon tip tanks on each side. They look like little torpedoes, but they're actually fuel tanks. And so that's 612 pounds of fuel on each wingtip. And, you know, that's way out there. The wing is built like a tank. But to fuel the airplane, well, in the United States, if you have a fuel truck with two hoses and two line people, you can just fill each tank simultaneously. But what we did, the locker tanks, we only used on a handful of legs. But what you do is you fuel the two main tanks first, and then you go to one of the tip tanks and you fill it about halfway. And as you do it, the airplane will lean markedly in the direction of that tank. Then you go over to the other side, fill the other tip full, and then go back to the first tip and top it off. So it's kind of a, you know, I call it the MU2 refueling dance. And the one thing I never did really get to photograph or video was the refueling dance from the front, where you could actually see the airplane lean to one side, then lean to the other, and then come back normal. But most of the places we went, people had never seen the MU2. In a couple, it's like, oh yeah, we remember that, but they hadn't seen it in years. So through Indonesia and places, the MU2 was definitely an oddity. We had a lot of people saying, and Mike's airplane was in beautiful shape, you know, nice paint in a number of places. People thought, oh, this is a new design. And when you told them it was, you know, conceived and first flew 50 years ago, you could see the synapses in their heads just kind of start to pop. Because like, really? And so so I quickly became, it became one of my duties, on my primary duty on the ground, was to supervise the fueling, because every place we stopped almost, it was, you know, training a new ramp crew. So that freed Mike up to deal with flight planning or anything that he had to do. So we managed to have some pretty quick turns that way. But yeah, it was, it's an interesting, well, and then the other thing you have to watch folks doing is make sure the ladder is not under those tips, because in the history of the MU2, more than one ladder has met its fate with a filling tip tank. And I've told folks that, you know, to move the ladder back a little bit, and they'd look at me, you know, and in many of these places, the ramp crew did not speak English, but they'd look at me like, you're crazy. And they did it because I asked them to, and I was probably wearing a shirt with captain stripes, so they figured they had to. But then later, when they started out, you know, filling that tip and reaching up to the opening, and then when they finished and it was down below the top of their ladder, they gave me that knowing look like, oh, thanks for calling that out, because they realized pretty quickly that, you know, that if the tank landed on the ladder, it was not going to be good for the tip tank or the ladder. So
you mentioned uniforms, and I think I read in your blog or in some account that in some areas and some cultures it was important for you to wear uniforms, and in others it didn't really matter. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, it's definitely true. I've heard about it forever. You know, there's basically, when we left Germany and went through the Persian Gulf and down through India to basically till we got to Australia, we wore our pilot uniforms. And then when we left Australia up basically all the way up through Russia till we got to Alaska, and the these countries, a lot of the controllers and the pilots all speak enough aviation English to, you know, to be able to handle traffic. You really have to watch your vocabulary and don't stray far from the recommended phraseology, because you can quickly get to the edge of a controller's envelope with respect to English. But the The ramp crews and the customs and immigration, in some cases, we had to work with a lot of folks who did not speak English fluently, if at all. And the uniform is just a big deal. I've had friends that have ferried Skyhawks back and forth to Europe and other parts of the world, and even flying a 172. There are just places where you wear this uniform to get the respect and the attention and everything. This was really my first opportunity going through any of those parts of the world as a GA crew member. And I can't imagine going through some of those places without handlers, and I can't imagine doing it without the uniforms. A lot of the countries, don't have much at all in the way of general aviation. There were quite a few places where we actually were parked on the air carrier ramp in front of the terminal building. And we would go into the terminal building and get shepherded to the front of the line for customs and immigration. And, certainly having a uniform there was very handy because, people, I guess, are just used to people with uniforms going in front of them. If we'd been wearing blue jeans and T-shirts, I think it would have been, a little bit of a social faux pas.
Rob, do you have a uniform in your closet that you can pull out when you need to be impressive?
If I told you the answer to that question, you and everyone else that's listening would go, "Oh, I believe that." Actually, in another, right over here, about 5 feet away from me, I have this great old sweater I used to wear when I was flying 135, and it had the company initials on it, and we had the hooks for the epaulets in there, and they still have my four bars in there, and I just. I when I really want to feel like I'm doing something valuable, I put my sweater on and sit around and go. But once you have them, you don't ever want to get rid of them. They are kind of cool.
Your wife doesn't want to do any like role playing or that kind of thing.
She makes me. I can't bring it in the house.
Yeah, okay.
Although what Mike said earlier, I think is really important about how much extra respect you get when you're wearing a uniform. And I'm beginning to think that maybe I've been missing my useful tip all these years.
I've thought about since I have invested in a couple of shirts and some epaulets, I've thought about wearing them sometime when I'm going somewhere as a passenger on a U.S. airline, just to see if it helps with the whole respect thing. I haven't done it yet, but it'd be interesting. It may not work as well here as it does in other parts of the world.
Well, my guess, though, Mike, is that it's not the fact that you have the epaulets on that might be the issue. Is that there probably aren't a whole lot of U.S. airlines that allow pilots with beards.
That's interesting. Is that, you think that's true? Is that an issue?
I don't know of any airline that'll let them do that, but
no. It's not necessarily that they're opposed to beards, but I think what it really comes down to is being able to don an oxygen mask in a hurry when you're up at the flight levels. And so, we did this whole trip at pretty much at 25,000 feet, and so we weren't. If we'd had a pressurization problem, I think I would have been able to get enough oxygen that it wouldn't have been an issue. And, we'd still have, a much higher, Rob, I'm sure you can quote the time of useful consciousness, but, at 25,000 at flight level 250, you've got a little while. It's not like you're up at 39 or 41 where it's measured in seconds.
No, and that's absolutely true. That's what I had heard for years, was that it was an oxygen mask issue more than anything else. Although I did see, in fact, I think when I was in Ireland, I had a chance to jump seat on an Aer Lingus flight once, and I'm not mistaken, I think one of the guys had a beard, but that might be wrong.
Mike, let's talk about flight planning a little bit. How much flight planning can you accomplish sort of in advance, and how much do you have to do on the spot that day for the flight that day? Do you have to change plans a lot?
No, really the planning was all done. Mike hired a handling company to deal with our international entries and exits in most of the countries we went to. And he also contracted with them to do the flight planning. So the basic plan and the route we had we had done months before the trip. We had a few changes. One of the things that that we wanted to do, because we were flying around the globe from west to east, and had really the only place we really wanted to be at a certain time was in Nagoya for the anniversary of the MU-2's first flight. So that was, you know, on the back end of the trip. So we wanted to build in a couple of days of flexibility so that if we got behind because of weather or a mechanical or something, we could still, you know, make our schedule. And as it turns out, we didn't need any of that time, but we did have a couple of flex days built in. And one of them, in an earlier version of the plan, we were going to stop for fuel in Luxor, Egypt, which is where the pyramids are. And Mike called me a couple of times. You know, we were kind of agonizing. He said, well, you know, we don't really need a flex day at that point of the trip, but if we're going to be in Luxor, you know, maybe we should just plan a day there so we can go be tourists and see the pyramids. And I said, you know, I think you're right. It's kind of a once in a lifetime thing. So let's do that. So we changed the plan so that we would have a day there. A week later, there was a little coup in Egypt, and we followed things pretty closely for a couple weeks. The State Department was basically saying, don't go to Egypt. And, you know, we were hearing news reports about unrest at the pyramids. And, you know, Mike and I talked, and I said, he said, you know, we should maybe it's time to check with base ops, our handler, and see what they say. And he said, good idea. I'll call them. And he called me back about an hour later, and he said, we're not even going to Egypt now. It's just, you know, the coup ruined my chance to see the pyramids. But, you know, but the planning was really, you know, changed very little. The route and the approximate schedules were all set, and so every morning Mike would get both emailed and faxed a kind of a briefing packet, which had the weather and the flight plan information. The flight plans generally were already filed. There were a few countries that would not accept the handling company's flight plans, and we would have to file it ourselves, the exact same plan, because we just, you know, read off the plan that they'd already filed. But certain countries, you know, like to do things their way, I guess. And so, you know, that was a little bit of inefficiency, but it only happened a handful of times. The plan itself was never rejected. It was just the way that they got it didn't sit well with somebody, or didn't, you know, for whatever reason, they wanted it filed by the pilot personally. We never really knew why. It's just occasionally the plan had to be refiled. So.
And what was your reception like at Nagoya when you arrived?
Oh, well, it was actually very impressive. There were probably 70 or 80 people there at the airport to greet us. A number of them were folks from Mitsubishi, some of them, you know, wearing dress shirts and ties, some of them wearing the blue coveralls that the factory workers wear. But then there were also, I noticed, standing outside the fence on a stairway into an office building, there were a couple of photographers photographing our arrival. The Mitsubishi folks were incredibly welcoming. The company they have not abandoned the MU-2 by any means, but most of the service and support for the MU-2 has been handled by Mitsubishi's North American Aviation subsidiary. So, you know, they hadn't been directly involved other than maybe parts supply or things like that. But they were clearly very appreciative of the journey and this and the symbolism of you know, being in Nagoya for the anniversary. And you know, they just rolled out the red carpet for us. We had a lunch in one of their corporate boardrooms, and then they actually have an aviation museum of their own. I guess it opens to the public a couple times a year, but it's in the middle of a secure factory complex, so you can't just show up and look at this museum. But we got a guided tour of their aviation museum. It was all fascinating stuff.
Very cool. And we should mention that Mike sent along some photos, and we have some links to AOPA articles and I guess a video as well that we'll have in the show notes. So if you're interested in learning more, seeing more about this trip, this fantastic trip,
I was going to ask Mike, is there a part of the trip that stands out to you as wow? I mean, not that all of it wouldn't be wow when you're going around the world, but I don't know, maybe something that kind of jumped out at you.
You know, there's a whole lot of things that come back as memories. But, you know, one of the things that, two instances, I guess, and it's both pilot-related, pilot camaraderie in different parts of the world. You know, Australia, not so much of a challenge because we speak basically the same language. But when we actually made a fuel stop, an overnight and a fuel stop at Ayers Rock, which is in the middle of Australia, it's about the only thing in the middle of Australia, based on my observations. So we didn't stop there to be tourists, but it was the logical place to stop for fuel. And they have a charted sightseeing route around Ayers Rock, just very similar to what the U.S. has over the Grand Canyon, for example. And we had that and had briefed it and decided that we would fly this route on our arrival. And there was a Gipps air van doing a tour, and we're following along, and we're coordinating with each other over the radio, and we're finishing the route about the same point in time. And it was just impossible for the MU2 to stay behind this air van and make it, you know, back to the airport. So we coordinated an overtake on the CTAF down there, and the pilot said, sure, that was fine. So we overtook well abeam and went back to the airport. And then somebody else, I think flying a helicopter on the tour, came on the radio, and the pilot is talking about the pilot of the air van and said, ah, and the speed queen is overtaken. So apparently she had the reputation for being the fastest local pilot. And, you know, we, I guess, tarnished that reputation, and it led to a bunch of laughter on the frequency. So, but the other time was probably even more touching to me when we were on the way into Anadyr, Russia, our last fuel stop in Russia. The airport was on the top of a bluff up above an inlet to, I forget what the body of water, but it basically connects to the ocean. And we're flying the ILS. We're probably 8 or 10 miles out, but we're behind a Russian helicopter. And the pilot comes on and says, in a very thick accent, he says, wind shear. And so Mike and I are looking at each other, and we're following along on the glide path. And then we hear the pilot talking to air traffic control, and the controller, who had better English, came back and told us that there was strong wind shear on short final. And then a couple minute or two later, the helicopters landed, and he said, gone by runway. And sure enough, you know, we're trucking on down final, short final, and hit that wind shear, and it was like nobody's business. If we hadn't been forewarned, we would have been putting the coals to it and going around. But, you know, we knew it was pretty short, and sure enough, we came over the numbers, it smoothed out, and we touched down. So it was just, the same way that you'll hear pilots giving each other, that kind of information here in the States. This Russian helicopter pilot, didn't want to let the language barrier keep him from sharing that little bit of information with us.
Hmm. Mike, if you think about it, there being a sort of a scale, a spectrum, where at one end is doing a flight like this is definitely doable, to the other end of the extreme, which might be you got to be out of your mind to try something like this. Where do you think this falls on that spectrum?
You know, it ended up, it's really way more doable than I would have thought, to tell you the truth. Well, and I should qualify that, because some of the things that Mike chose to do, like use the flight planning service and use the handlers, you know, sure, that's going to run your cost up, but you know, there's a value in that. And most of these places where we had to go through these mazes of customs and immigration, you know, just to spend the night and then repeat the process the next morning, these handlers got us usually through the whole process in 10 or 15 minutes each way. No time at all, because half of that was walking places. And then, you know, they look at your passport and maybe you get stamped, maybe you don't. But there are probably places where we would still be wandering around now, 6 months later, yeah, trying to find the right office and, you know, get the right stuff done had we not opted to use some of those services. So, you know, if you use services like that and plan prudently, you know, using your, you know, you can do an awful lot with ship's fuel and in a lot of airplanes if you just plan it out. It was eye-opening to me how easy it all was once we got going and you know, we kind of made the jump from the planning to the execution phase. And it really, other than the language and clearing in and out of customs every night and every morning, it wasn't a whole lot and the scenery, but you know, but the flying was really not a whole lot different than you know, a longer trip might be here in the United States.
So it sounds like you were easily able to enjoy the experience.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Great. Well, we didn't leave much time to talk about aviation photojournalism, but I just want to touch on that real quick. For folks who maybe think about a career in aviation photojournalism, what's it like out there? What are the prospects like? Is this something that's really hard to break into these days?
I hate to say it, but photojournalism right now in any area, aviation or anything else, is probably a tough place to get a start. There are not a lot of opportunities. You know, photojournalism traditionally has its roots in newspapers and in magazines, and the newspaper industry, maybe more than any other, has just really taken a beating over the last decade or so. A lot of newspapers are downsizing. What was it? The Chicago Sun-Times, I think, actually laid off its entire photo staff. They said, well, you know what? We'll just have reporters take photos with their iPhones. I think they've actually maybe recanted and hired a few photographers because they realized that wasn't working out. But it's a tough place to be right now when you're starting out. But, you know, for somebody who really has the drive and the motivation, the rewards can be, you know, very gratifying. I'll put in a plug for the International Society for Aviation Photography. It's a group of a group that exists to encourage aviation photography, everything from amateurs to professionals. And it has been my privilege in more than 10 years with that group to see some folks start out as beginners and go on to get jobs at companies like Lockheed Martin or you know, other big aerospace companies. But the anybody interested in what we call ISAP, there's a website, aviationphoto.org, and the organization has an annual symposium. This year's symposium will be in Tampa, Florida in April, the 3rd, 4th, 5th. So during Sun and Fun, we think some folks might spend some time at Sun and Fun and then, you know, piggyback that on with the symposium. So if anybody wants information, it's available on the ISAP website.
Fascinating. That sounds like that'd be very exciting. One last question for me anyway on just aviation photography, and maybe this is a sort of a backdoor way to kind of get some tips, perspectives on aviation photography. When you think of the photographs that you've taken that you're proudest of or that are the most meaningful to you, what are those like? How do you characterize those pictures?
Well, the most meaningful to me, and probably it's my background as a photojournalist, is not necessarily going to be the photos that I think are the prettiest photos or the hardest to get photos. I want a photo that has some substance to it. And one of my favorites from the past couple years was a steerman, a Boeing steerman. I had seen a little thing, a little paragraph in the New York Times email newsletter about a pilot in California had a steerman that he found out had originally been assigned to Tuskegee, Alabama, when it was built during World War II, and its first mission, its first assignment for the Army Air Corps was training some of the Tuskegee Airmen. Huh. And this gentleman was Matt Quay, and the Smithsonian talked him out of his airplane. It's actually on temporary display at the Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center at Dulles Airport, but it's actually going to go into the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is being built now in D.C., opens in 15, I think. But anyway, I saw this, and I immediately, the journalist in me thought, wow, a Tuskegee steerman, how cool would it be to photograph that airplane at Tuskegee, where the National Park Service has restored some of the complex where the Tuskegee Airmen trained. So I got on Google and I found this guy and I called him up and I introduced myself and I said, I really want to do a story on your steerman and the trip, you know, where it's going to Washington. And he said, oh, that'd be great. I said, but I got to ask you, I said, have you thought about going to Moton Field in Alabama? He said, oh, yeah. He said, we're going to go to Minnesota, we're going to go to Oshkosh, and then we're going to go down to Alabama for a day on the way to Washington. And I said, well, I would like to know what day you're going to be in Alabama. I want to meet you there and do air-to-air photography over the hangar complex. He wanted to fly there, but he hadn't really thought through documenting what he was going to do. He was immediately on board, and that's what we did. The story was in Pilot. It's probably been a couple years now, but that particular airplane, that original Tuskegee Stearman flying over the airspace where it operated in 1944 and 45, you know, not what a photographer would look at out of my photos from that year and say, that's your best picture. But to me, it was the most important because of the story it told.
Yeah, sure. Very good. All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Tell our listeners, are there some places where people can find you online that we can direct them to?
Well, I think there's a link to the story about my around the world trip that you're going to put up with your show notes.
Yes.
Anybody can, my email address is at the end of that, or they can email me at mike.collins@aopa.org. We're usually pretty easy to find, you know, do the Facebook and social media stuff too. But direct email is probably the best place. If anybody has a question, I'm happy to do what I can to answer it.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, gents.
Rob, do you have to peel off?
Yeah, but not without saying I just can't imagine that all that flying without a potty in the bathroom. Okay, Mike's a braver guy than I am. Yeah, I do have to run. And Mike, it's been really great having you on board, and I'm glad you were able to come and talk to us about this flight.
Appreciate the invitation, and you know, if I do anything else noteworthy, feel free. I'd love to do it again. So
fantastic. Yeah, we'd love to have you back.
You mean come on the show or take the around the world trip?
Yes.
And now with his aircraft of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Okay, well, it's not an airplane. Well, I guess it is an airplane, but we're going to talk about the Augusta Westland AW-139. We're recording this on Monday night, February 3rd, so I thought this was an appropriate day to do this, which was first flown on February 3rd, 2001, the AW-139 was designed to replace the Bell Huey. Augusta had been building the Huey under license. In 1998, the Bell Augusta Aerospace Corporation was created. The BAAC would create the AB-139 with Augusta as lead and the tiltrotor BA-609 as Bell as lead. Eventually, Bell would back out of the contracts and they would both become Augusta Westland aircraft, the AW-139 and the AW-609. The AW-139 is a twin-engined, single-rotor helicopter, two Pratt & Whitney PT-6C-67Cs, each developing 1,531 horsepower each. They drive a five-blade carbon fiber fully articulated rotor. The titanium holds the 1,609 square feet of rotor space. The 139 is a conventional helicopter with a four-bladed articulated tail rotor on the right side. The PT-6s are FADECT, or Fully Authorized Digital Engine Control. This allows the crew of two to manage the engines. The Flight Management System, or FMS, is programmed with the winds, temperature, cruise altitude, etc. The FADECT system then sets the engines at the proper speed for efficiency. The cockpit is a multifunction glass display. The 139 can be flown in instrument conditions by a single pilot. It also has a four-axis autopilot, which allows for auto-hover functions. It also has a complete search and weather radar suite. The 139 cabin is fully integrated with night vision goggles. The 139 has a cabin capable of holding 15 passengers in three rows of five seats. The spacious cabin can also be fitted with various sensor positions, extra fuel tanks, and the aircraft is truly multi-mission and has found roles in paramilitary, military, and civilian organizations. In September of 2000, Bristol Helicopters became the launch client. The 139 reached JAA certification in Europe in June 2003, with FAA certification in December 2004. In its medical evac form, it could hold up to four stretchers with five attendants and a complete medical suite. The Japanese Coast Guard and Irish Air Corps chose it as their primary helicopter. In 2001, Augusta Westland decided to produce the aircraft at KPNE, or Northeast Philadelphia International Airport. They are currently producing 90 airframes a year. The 139 has been given a 10-foot plug, and Augusta Westland is marketing the larger 149 and 189 to directly compete with the Sikorsky S-70 Blackhawk family. After 13 years after its first flight, the 139 is a success and will be for the years to come, which makes this historian happy because I get to see a lot of shiny new helicopters being test flown over my office. So, on its 13th anniversary, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thanks, David. Yeah, boy, those PT-6 engines, they show up in a huge number of different aircraft, fixed wing and rotary.
It's become the R2800 of the modern age.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 2nd of February, 2014. Well, g'day, folks, and it's just me here in the studio yet again. I'm afraid that, unfortunately, Steve's... hang on.
Grant, it's me, Steve. Let me in.
Yeah, pull the other one. Like, I'm going to believe that.
It's definitely me, mate. I've come back to do all the editing this week.
Hey, Steve, dude, come right on in.
You sounded a little suspicious there, mate.
Well, I wasn't really sure, but dude, nice wheelchair you've got. Very Davros looking.
Yeah, no worries. Let me just ratchet myself back into the studio here. It's a little bit awkward these days.
Hang on, we'll move the desk out so you can get that motorized unit in there.
Yes, no worries. Yes. Well, boy, I'm back. Boy, I didn't think I was going to make it back.
Boom, baby. Well, you're allowed back in because you said the magic word, editing by Steve.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, well, editing, even editing couldn't be as painful mental as the what I've been through the last few weeks. It's nice to be back here in the studio, mate.
Oh, good. Well, hopefully we can give you some heaps of work to do to take your mind off that swollen, pained knee.
And if you're new to the show and you're wondering what on earth we're talking about, well, I've been away for the last month having my right knee reconstructed and a very, well, shall we say, interesting experience, Grant. I've never been in so much pain in all of my life, I can tell you. But so if anybody's thinking of having it, dear listeners, I wouldn't recommend it unless it's absolutely necessary.
Remember, folks, don't try and twist, turn, throw in the basketball.
Yes, especially if you're my age. Anyway.
Well, mate, you may have been out for a month, but some of the crew have been stepping in and helping out. Hopefully we haven't left the studio too trash for you.
No, no, it looks pretty good in here. And apart from all the beer bottles, I can tell you've been here. But yes, thanks to Kathy and the two Bens and Damo and everybody else who stepped in from the team in my absence. And thanks to you for doing the editing, mate. So let's get on this week, seeing as I'm doing all the work. We can't talk too much. Let's kick it off by talking about Qantas maintenance. Now, Grant, there was some talk that Qantas were going to move their 747 maintenance up to Brisbane when they announced several weeks ago now that they were closing the Avalon base down here in Victoria. I don't really think any of us were fooled by that, were we? As Qantas announced in the news this week that they will, in fact, be establishing maintenance for the remaining 747s in the fleet outside of Australia, most likely in Asian countries somewhere.
They were sort of hinting, they weren't promising, and who believes them anyhow? You know, they're rapidly becoming politicians, even though, of course, the Australian politicians aren't really doing anything to help them at the moment. So it's more of the same, I think, for Qantas. But there is a bit of Qantas news that's interesting and new. That's General Cosgrove is going to quit the Qantas board because he's going off to become the Governor General.
Yes, of course. Now, this is retired Army General Peter Cosgrove, who was really shot to fame here in Australia 10 or 12 years ago when Australia went over and intervened there militarily in East Timor. And, of course, General Cosgrove was at the head of that operation and has really remained quite a public figure ever since. Now, he retired from the military back in about 2005 and has been doing lots of other work since that time. And interestingly, Grant, as you mentioned, he has also been on the board of Qantas, which, now, I'll confess here, I actually did not know that. But now that he's been appointed as the next Governor-General, of course, he has to resign from that position. So I guess there's a board vacancy there at Qantas now. So there you go. Now, Peter Cosgrove, a man of quite some quality. I'm surprised, given so many ructions that have been going on there in the world of Qantas politically over the last few years, that I would have thought that a level head like his, well, imagine if it had not been there, I guess.
Yeah, well, there is always that possibility. But speaking of board positions, Virgin, apparently going to open up three new board positions. So there's one each for Etihad, Air New Zealand, and Singapore International Airlines. You know, the big three that dumped a lot of money into Virgin Domestic.
Well, that should have Alan Joyce really enthusiastic, I would think.
Mate, I suspect we're going to hear more doom, gloom, it's all imbalanced and nobody loves me and it's all so hard for us very soon now.
Yeah, well, he might be taking that hard, Grant, and I'm sure he'll be expressing his views on that subject in the weeks to come. But, you know, talking about hard, let's talk about hard landings and not actually in Australia, but just out in the South Pacific in the Solomon Islands. An Airworks 737-300 has made a rather rough landing. In fact, looks like he's going to be sitting on that runway at Honiara for quite some time. Grant, the landing gear has collapsed. What happened?
Well, mate, apparently the aircraft touched down, and not long after, during the rollout, the right main gear collapsed. It's possible it was already in the middle of braking. Some photos show that one of the thrust reverser cans is open on one side. I haven't been able to see the other side, so the expectation is that they'd pop the reversers, were partway through landing, and the right main gear collapses, and the poor aircraft, Zulu Kilo Tango Lima Charlie, operated by Airwork out of New Zealand, and an ex-US Air 737-300, now converted to a freighter, wound up sliding down the runway for a short distance before grinding to a halt and having to be bulldozed off.
Yeah, there we go. Now, that aircraft runs a freight run three times a week, according to this article here in the australian.com.au. And Grant, it runs from the Solomon Islands, stops in Nauru, and then comes into Australia. Now, Grant, Tango Lima Charlie, how apt? Perhaps they'll have to start treating that aircraft with a bit more TLC.
TLC, yeah, that's the one, mate. That's the one.
I might still be half full of anaesthetic, but I can still pull off one-liners like that, mate.
Well, mate, someone who's not pumped up with anaesthetic and fully firing on all cylinders is the RAAF C-27J transition team. They are now in charge.
Yep, they'll be pretty happy about that there at the RAF too, mate. According to this article here in australianaviation.com.au, the Air Force has handed command of 30 Fire Squadron temporarily over to the C-27J transition team back on January 21st as the first of 10 aircraft prepares to fly to the US for its systems fit-out. Now, Grant, while I was lying in hospital, I was looking at quite a lot of pictures on my iPad of that aircraft number one for the RAF over there at the Alenia factory in Italy, and it's been out doing a lot of flight testing. I think we may have reported on that several weeks ago. So interesting that it's going over to Waco in Texas to have a final fit out.
Yeah, well, I guess it's because that's where the Yanks were doing their final fit outs after Alenia produced the C-27. And then it would be sent over to Waco and the final fit out work to meet US requirements would be made over there. So it seems to make sense. Alenia builds the airframe and gets it all up to speed. And then it comes across to Waco, gets its final fit out up to American specs, which is what we've bought. And then it comes down to us.
Well, I guess you'll have plenty of aircraft that they can use as a template over there in the US, because I saw an article this week in Stars and Stripes actually talking about all the C-27s that the US forces have ordered that were built and put straight into storage in Arizona. What a waste. But I think they've since been taken up by other parts of their forces. But gee, what a waste. So, you know, the RAF, if they'd been really clever, they could have picked a few of those up for Nick's.
Oh, I know. They could have really, you know, done the usual, go down, get five, put them all together, have four, and away you go.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of all things military, Grant, just before we finish this week, let's talk about the Royal New Zealand Air Force. They've been looking for new trainers, and it looks like they've settled on the T-6C.
That's right, mate. They've got the Texan 2. This is the one from Hawker Beechcraft. These aircraft will be a little more powerful than you're going to find here in Australia with our PC-9s. So, yeah, good on the Kiwis replacing the CT-4E piston trainers and the King Airs and going to one of these.
Absolutely, I guess. So that'll be good. They can train so many pilots for their Strike Fighter Force grant.
So moving right along.
Is this thing working?
yeah. We could, the Kiwis could very much do with some strike aircraft. I mean, yeah, they can put some gear under the hard points and go and use it for, you know, forward air control and counterinsurgency like the Australians do with the PC-9, I guess. But yeah, I guess, you know, this is the best we can get.
Yeah, it's the poor old Kiwi Air Force. You know, I always feel sorry for our brothers across the Tasman when we talk about their Air Force, because I know a lot of people over there in Kiwi land are very, very unhappy all these years later that they're fighter jets. Not that they had many, but, you know, it was an important part of regional defence, I thought, plus the fact that they were all based over here in Australia. So,
well, that was at the end. A number of them were based in New Zealand until they finally moved them over here to do assistance to the Australian Navy, but which was rather apt because a lot of the aircraft that the Kiwis wound up flying had actually been ex-Royal Australian Navy A-4s. But, yeah, the A-4s did actually get to fire their guns in anger. One put a few rounds across the bow of a ship that was trying to steam its way out of the New Zealand fisheries area. So they got sprung fishing when they shouldn't have been, and an A4 put a few bullets across its bow, and that managed to get them to go, okay, we'll stop before you run into us.
Just think, Grant, if they'd actually bought all those F-16s that they were offered on the cheap, they probably could have put a Sparrow missile into him or something.
Yeah, that would have worked.
Well, enough picking on the Kiwis, Grant. You know, they'll start beating us in rugby again, or worse, they'll beat us in the cricket, so we better not get them too angry.
Oh, mate, beating Australia in the rugby. Oh, mate, yeah, sun comes up as well, you know, every day. Same kind of thing. The All Blacks beat the Aussies all the time. Now that I've placated the Kiwis and offended the Aussies, I think I'd better move on.
No worries. Well, you know, before you offend anybody else, that's everything we have for you this week. Until next week, I'm Steve, One Leg Vischer.
And I'm Grant, soon to be married, McCarran.
Boy, I tell you, David, it's really good to hear Steve's back in front of the mic, isn't it?
We have to give Grant credit. He pulled it together, and the rest of the gang did a really good job in Steve's absence, but it is nice hearing our friend back.
Yeah, and you're right. The other guys, they stepped up to it, and that's just fantastic. It just indicates the passion and enthusiasm that these guys have for aviation and what they do.
Thanks to Grant and the Bens and everybody else and Kathy for substituting for Steve, and it just shows you how many people it takes to substitute for Steve.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
Shall we move on to listener mail?
Yeah, and first off, let's start off with an item we got from Andrew. This actually came in as a comment in one of the episode posts. And Andrew sent us a link to a YouTube video that he's created. He said, I just made this video of the Hawaii Mars water bomber. And this is the Martin Mars water bomber tribute. And this is an interesting aircraft. It's a seaplane that's now used as a water bomber. And he's got some great videos of the plane in the water, taking off, landing, and dropping water on fires and so forth. But, David, doesn't this plane, the Martin Mars, it has its origins, what, in the Second World War as a Navy craft?
It was the largest flying boat built for the Navy. Actually, they built four of them. And the Mars, and there's one left flying, and I don't think it will be firefighting any longer. I think basically it's served its life, and maybe hopefully it'll be put into a museum. But beautiful aircraft, but big, and they were used to transport material during World War II from the West Coast to Hawaii.
Hmm. Yeah, big high wing, four giant radial engines. Really nice. I bet that makes some great sounds. We heard from Bob. Bob says, "Hi, guys. I was surprised to hear you say in the last podcast that you did not know we Brits had no aircraft carriers and hence no Harriers." He says, "I believe I am right in saying that they and the spare parts were snapped up by the U.S. Marines. It's a real disgrace and hence no Royal Navy pilots with fast jet experience. Next thing you know, the Royal Navy will be down to two rowboats." So he says, "Keep up the good work." And that's from Bob. Yeah, it was the Marines, right, David, that purchased the...
Yeah, we bought all the GR-7s and the GR-9s. And for a while there, they were talking about reforming squadrons, but it sounds like with sequestration, they're just becoming spare parts because the F-35 has yet to come online and we need to keep our Harriers flying. So, but yeah, the two aircraft carriers that are being built will be for the F-35, and that's the Queen
Sure.
Elizabeth class.
Ah, okay. We heard from Murray. Murray writes, "In the January 22nd episode, your comments seem to imply that the Sky Whale concept is significantly larger than the A380. And you'll recall in that episode, we talked about this design concept called the Sky Whale. And Murray says, "If you had looked at the plan view, you would have seen that the Sky Whale is not really longer or wider than an A380 or even the B747 for that matter. It has nearly a square dimension of length and width. The higher passenger capacity stems from the triple deck configuration and much wider passenger compartment." He says, "I, for one, would love to see such a striking and different plane in the sky instead of the umpteenth iteration of a long aluminum tube that could be mistaken for a B-29 at a distance." And that's from Murray. So good. I kind of like the thinking there, David, that airplanes look like airplanes pretty much for, I think, many valid good reasons. But it would be nice to sort of see something different.
Yeah, and we did all talk about we like the Sky Whale and its sort of lifting body shape. And, you know, we can dream.
That's right. We need dreamers in aviation as well as just in life in general. So that's always good. All right, so thanks, Murray. And let's see, we heard from Ray also. Ray sent in the link to Delta's 80s in-flight safety video. This is kind of making the rounds. Delta has created a very interesting safety video. We'll put the link in the show notes. You can see this on YouTube. And also an article from Fox News about this safety video. It's kind of fun to watch, Dave. I don't know if you had an opportunity, but there's a lot of celebrity cameos in there.
I just had horror flashbacks to my high school days. It's in commemoration of Delta's first video that they did. But yeah, it's definitely, if you survived the 80s, it's definitely worth a watch.
And another item also came in from Ray, another link. This is in the Miami Herald about, this is titled, "Group Plans to Bring Eastern Airlines Back to Miami." Kind of interesting. We'll put that in the show notes. It's not a rebirth of the same Eastern that we knew and loved or didn't back in the day. I think it's another example of where someone has acquired the trademark or the Eastern Airlines name and is using that and contemplating putting together an airline. Miami, I think Miami was the home of Eastern back then, although I was kind of young back then, so I'm not positive of the history there.
Yeah, I mean, Eastern started in Florida, in Miami. So I just hope they skip the blue and silver and go back to red, white, and blue eagles on the side of the airplane.
Yeah, that would be cool.
It would be really cool. But like a lot of people have said, starting an airline, even rebirthing an airline, is very, very hard in these days and age. So we'll have to follow Eastern Airlines.
Yeah, it requires usually a substantial stash of money to get that off the ground. And then, as they say, you can watch it sort of disappear slowly. But not to be negative, hopefully that'll be a successful business venture. Ryan sent us in some links. He says, listening to the aeroplane of the week, and he says, yes, I was taught the proper way, A-E-R-O plane. He says, listening to the aeroplane of the week about the DC-9, so I thought I would share a few photos of a C-9 variant that visited Adelaide in 2009. He sends along some links to some photos, some great photos of the C-9 variant.
And interestingly enough, Ryan, that's the unit from Willow Grove.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, Julia Tango was VR-52, and that was... So we have seen the same C-9. How's that sound? I have all around the world. But yeah, the Julia Tango was out of Willow Grove, and VR-52 was my DC-9s.
And Ryan says that he's never flown on a true DC-9, as Ansett and TAA had phased them out when he was little. He said, however, I have flown on the 717, and he put a trip report online of that flight. That's on airliners.net, but we'll put a link to that one in the show notes also.
VR-52, just as a little side note, used to do, at Christmas, they would do a flight to the North Pole, where everybody would board the DC-9 and the little kids, and they would go take off and taxi down the runway. And next thing you know, by magic, they came back and they arrived at the hangar, and it was the North Pole, and Santa was there and stuff. It was always a very cool thing that the Navy did for the local kids in the area. Not that they ever flew, but the magic of going from one end of the runway in the DC-9 was very, very cool.
All right, great. We heard from Mike. Mike says, I know David is a big fan. Actually, he said a big turbo fan of looking out the window as the best in-flight entertainment system. Mike says, I am too, but I've never seen a good way of tracking locations on a commercial flight until now. He says, my iPad 2 has had some success below about 12,000 feet or so, but never higher. However, and he's attached an image of his new Google Nexus 7 running Navigator. And he says, as you can see, it worked great at cruise levels over California. We were at 36,000 feet at one point, according to the captain. Airports and landmarks are pretty much where you expected them, considering the distortion through a thick airplane window. So this, what he's got is on his tablet there, on his Nexus 7, being able to follow along the flight over a map of the ground. So this application that he's using, Navigator, is you can find that at www.navigatorapp.com. So I want to thank Mike for passing that one along. All right, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Mike Collins, writer, photographer with AOPA and others. Great conversation. We'll put links to the items we mentioned concerning the round-the-world flight, as well as some others that Mike mentioned. And we want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and yes again, Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And also we'll look forward to Peter Johnson joining again soon with his Across the Pond segment. Meantime, you can find his podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right. If you haven't figured it out by now, Rob Mark had to peel off due to another commitment. So it's just David and I at this point. But David, why don't you tell folks where they can find you online, and maybe you can mention a few places where they can find Rob.
Well, if you Google Jetwine, that covers pretty much the whole universe Rob Mark lives. But you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. But most of all, you should start listening to Max and I every Friday morning on the UAV Digest podcast.
Yeah, we're getting some good listenership going with that, and it's been an interesting ride with David as we explore drones and UAVs and UASs and all that sort of thing in what's happening in that industry. We continue to think this is going to be a big growth area, and we have, of course, a lot of excitement, or maybe lack thereof, as the FAA sort of slowly moves towards establishing the regulations for drones and such. You can also find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight, the UAVDigest.com with David, and at RunwayGirlNetwork.com for the Passenger Experience podcast, the PaxX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 285. If you want to go straight to that episode, you can use the shortcut airplanegeeks.com/285. You'll find show notes there with lots of links. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us. Also, stream us on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Our Aunt Benet, the aviation queen, has something to say about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
There's indications it may have been a hard landing, but the aircraft, I'm trying to have a look at its history. sorry, mate, I don't have much luck finding its goddamn
history. Jeez, we're a bit rusty at this, aren't we?
Well, it has been a little while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Who knew? We could bounce this badly off each other.
We should almost start this one again.
You reckon? If you want to, we probably can. Sorry, well, I just get back into my wheelchair.
Well, if you start talking about all things Doctor Who, Grant, there's only going to be two people at the Airplane Geeks who've got any idea what you're talking about besides you.
Yeah, but there's a lot of cool people in the audience. They'll totally get it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going back to my current...